Before I begin again, I just want to dedicate this year to an individual, Rini Molko. Her name is Regina Bath Yosef Reuven. And this year should go in the memory of her and his Aliyah's Neshama. The source of this year should be from Aliyah's Neshama of Regina Bath Yosef Reuven. In any case, we have, so far I've been given material or understandings of the blueprint of creation, and that's really what the shurim are. They go into the blueprint. The shurim are not, they're not sermons, they're not drushes, or in Yiddish, they're not vertlich, they're not musashmuzen. It's really all about what is, what will be the messianic era. And, you know, how do we explain the different situations that we witness and so on, the tremendous corruption of mankind and the entire, what do you call it, program that the Rebbe Hashem has set aside. Decided that what I'd like to do is give a shiur about something which is fascinating. which, in a certain sense, you don't really have a shiur on this topic. And that is that part of the blueprint of creation is really how it was created, how it really was created. And I'd like you to give people a Kabbalistic understanding of how the world is created and what eventually will transpire. And so on, you see. And to explain some of the phenomena that science recognizes, which makes absolutely no sense. The name of the theory that I'm going to try to tackle and explain it Kabbalistically is called quantum mechanics. It's really about the motion of atomic particles. That's what it's about. And I would imagine everybody has some kind of inkling. Everybody's heard, you know, the fundamental units of matter we know is atoms. And atoms consist of many, many subparticles, chief of which is a neutron, which is in the middle of the atom. And it contains two particles, minimally, which is a proton and a neutron. And these themselves are further subdivided into smaller particles, which is beyond belief anyway, you see. And the atom, of course, is extremely small. And circling the atom, keeping it simple, we know is electrons. And the atom is the fundamental unit of matter, and so on. And there are many phenomena which occur that scientists have no concept of what and why it's happening. So what I want to do is explain these concepts or phenomena and connect it to Kabbalah and how you see what Kabbalah really is and why these phenomena exist and what will be in the end and so on. So it's really an attempt to understand based on Judaism or the Judaic view of the blueprint of creation, what really happened and so on, you know. And there are different ways to begin, okay. But the one of the most fundamental problems today, which I'm sure everybody's heard about, is a concept called the Big Bang. And what happened was in the 20s, there was a guy, Edwin Hubble, who discovered that galaxies, first of all, he discovered that there are many galaxies altogether. In the beginning, they thought there was only one. Everything is part of that one galaxy. But now, of course, he discovered that the universe has many galaxies. Okay. And that was the first big discovery, that there's not one galaxy in the universe. There are trillions of galaxies, which is beyond belief. And each galaxy can have a trillion stars. And you could begin Hello?
Hello?
Put yourself.
Yeah. And you could begin to understand the size of the universe, which of course is beyond belief. And remember, all of it is emanated from God, so you can imagine if you had a look at God and his size, well, he's at least as big as the entire universe. But anyway, so the question is, so he discovered that, and then he discovered something even more extraordinary, and that is that the further a galaxy is away from us, distant, it is actually expanding. It's moving at a certain rate, but the rate of moving increases the further a galaxy is away. That's what he also discovered, which of course changed everybody's view of the size of the universe. But in any case, so what they figured or they realized is that if everything is moving away, expanding, well, what happens if you went back in time, you see? And all of a sudden, everything would now go backwards in time, which means it would start at one point, and that would explode with all these galaxies. That became a whole new field of searching for the scientific phenomena that occurred. But the big kasha, or I should say the big question is, wait a minute, if everything went back, if you go back in time, you know, and you reversed the expansion of the universe, well, ultimately it all comes back to a single point that has infinite density. Because could you imagine the entire universe, right, in one single dot, you see, which is beyond belief. And that, and then all of a sudden, it exploded. So the question is, if it exploded, then what went on before the explosion? In other words, what precedes the Big Bang? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. So this is the theory, actually most astronomers say they believe in this theory, is the concept of a Big Bang, that everything goes back to one point, which they call a singularity, and it was infinitely dense. Just imagine what it was. And all of a sudden it exploded, and we are witnessing the after effects of the explosion. And that's why all galaxies are moving away from each other, you see, because originally they were all together. Anyway, I don't want to go too technical, but that's fundamentally one of the greatest mysteries of science, you see. And the mystery is not only why there is this point, but what happened before that point, you see, because they feel, or they say, that this point, when there was an explosion, the initial billionth of a second, whatever, when everything exploded, so the question is, everything was formed with that explosion. That's when matter, energy, or I should say energy, time and space originated. That means before that explosion, there was no time, right? There was no energy, and there's no space. Now that itself, you have to, you know, think about what in the world does that mean. But this is what they say. So how do we explain this based on Judaism? Is there a Kabbalistic explanation for why this happened? Api Kabbalah. That is the question. And that's a very important idea, because in order to understand this, you have to know certain fundamental ideas Kabbalistically. So I just like to sort of like summarize, and then from that summary, you could begin to understand how Kabbalah looks at all this. And in many ways, this is what created everything, you see. Anyway, certain fundamental ideas, and that is that we know, which I've said many times, is that what the Baruch Hashem does is that he emits, in whatever way he does, 10 forces. And these forces, of course, are called spheres. We know that. And there are 10 of them. And these forces are used by the Ribbono Shel Olam to create all reality. And they do. They create all reality, these forces. So there are 10 forces. And what's interesting is that each force itself is subdivided into 10, you see? So if you have 10 forces, which you have Keser, Chochmah, Bina, you have Chesed, Gvur, and Tferes, you have Netzach, Hod, Yisoid, and Malchus, those are 10 forces, whatever, and each one itself is made of 10, which means that Keser has the same subdivision, which is Keser, Chochmah, Bina, Chesed, Gvura, and Tferes, Netzach, Hod, Yisoid, Malchus, and Malchus. And then these further ones are itself subdivided into 10. But without getting too complicated, all we have to do is consider the first 10 and their subdivisions. That means each one of the 10 has 10. So altogether, you could say there's 100 spheres. In any case, what they do is they create realities. That's how it's done. And to use a simple model, let's take a building. So we could say that the ground floor is these spheres with the greatest spiritual output. So they create the first reality, all 10 of them, plus their subdivisions of 10, right? They create the first reality called Olam Haba, the future world. And that is the greatest output of these spheres, which are pure spirituality. We have no idea what they really are, but they can create an entire reality. And remember, these are forces that God uses to do that. So that's the ground floor, which is the future world, Olam Haba. Then what they do is they diminish their output, whatever that means, and they create a second reality. Let's call that the first floor. We have the ground floor, which is the future world. And then they create the first floor above the ground, and that's called Olam Hazeh. And you have the first floor, second floor, third floor, and fourth floor. They create four floors, but all of them are Olam Hazeh, you see. So the first floor is called Atzilus. The second floor is lower, which means that the spheres diminish their output, and they create a reality called Bria, creation. And then they diminish further, and they create a third reality, right, which is called Yetzira. And then they create what is called Asiya, which is the lowest, where it diminishes further. Now remember, we're not talking here about this world. We are talking about worlds, or rather dimensions of reality, right, that existed before our world. But this is the origin, ultimately, of our world. You see, and the question is, of course, is, well, how do you go from spiritual forces creating different levels of reality, right, different dimensions, and I've numbered five of them, ground floor, first, second, third, and fourth floor, going up and so on, you see, how do you go from that to a physical world? Because we are not spiritual, or we certainly don't see spirituality. You see, and the answer is that a sphere in itself has what's called an aura. It's a light. It's really a tremendous spiritual force. But like every light has a glow. You see, there's the light itself, and then there's the glow of that light, or the radiance of that light. You see, so if you think about it, the forces would create, like I said, the future world, which is the ground floor, and then you go up first, second, third, and fourth floor. But remember, all of those floors are basically, right, spiritual. So how does this world emerge? And the way it emerges, which is really very interesting, is the last dimension, which is Asiya, creates what's called Olam HaShofel, which means the lower world. And that is our physical universe. But how do you go from Asiya, which is the world of action, that's what it's called, right, which is the fourth floor, how do you go to what's called Olam HaShofel, which is the physical world? And the idea to that is very interesting. What happens is, remember, everything is created from these forces, all dimensions of reality. So at the fourth floor, which I mentioned is Asiya, right? All of this is spiritual. Then what happens is that the last world, which we have, which is Olam Asiya, the glow of the spheres of that world basically all of a sudden diminishes, and all of a sudden it turns into the first thing that is created, and that is pure energy. Now, we don't know what energy is. Nobody knows what that is. We do know that energy allows objects to move, creates motion. But there is a concept called energy, and physics is the study of matter and energy. That we do know. So what happens is the glow of the lowest world changes or diminishes to such extent where it creates the most subtle form of, if we want to call it matter, or physicality. And that's pure energy. So what it does is it creates an energy block. It's like a soup of energy, you see, that it creates. That is the Big Bang. In other words, what happens is it's the action of the glow of the lowest world, as which is the sphere of that world, and all of a sudden the glow creates, it diminishes to the lowest possible extent spiritually, and then it creates this bowl, this soup of energy. Now, energy is physical, even though we don't know what it is, but it is physical. And that's what creates the Big Bang. And all of a sudden, spontaneously, it seems so, out of nowhere, the glow, which is called, by the way, the Ha'ora, of the awe of the spheres of that world, Asiya, right? All of a sudden changes, transforms, and it becomes pure energy. So this is the first appearance of physicality as pure energy, you see, that exists. And then that energy itself, when it appears, it's an explosion. It's almost like, all those, the spheres, the light itself and the glow of that sphere of the last world, which is Asiya, all of a sudden emerged from that and creates energy, which really is nothing more than the most subtle, fine type of physicality, even though we don't know what it is. Now, from that energy, simultaneously with this, I call it the energy block, the soup of energy, you also had the creation of space, of time, and then of energy, you see. So ultimately what happens is now, well, this energy, which is like a soup, so to speak, now has to create matter or stuff. Now we know, I mentioned this last week, that Einstein, his great chiddush, his great theory or whatever, said that energy and matter are identical. In other words, in some way, energy congeals or condenses, and it becomes matter. That was his discovery. And therefore, energy, whatever that is, and matter are really the same thing. In other words, energy has two forms. When it's pure energy, whatever that is, just picture a bowl of soup, and the soup is pure energy, right? Now, if you have particles in that energy soup, right, it happens because certain parts of the energy soup condense or congeal, and they become matter, atoms. You see, that's the way it works. You see, so therefore, the matter now becomes, emerges from the pure energy. And of course, once you have matter, right, you have all the 92 elements and so on, then that begins through the explosion, the entire entry of the entire world. So what the Big Bang really is the transition between a spiritual force, which is the spheres of the lowest world, right, which is Olam Asiya, and the glow of those spheres of Olam Asiya, the world of action, that glow turns into pure energy. So the lowest form of spirituality now becomes the most subtle form of physicality. Now, once you have the energy, let's say the soup of energy, that can now give rise to a different form, which is called matter. And that matter, of course, is the atoms, right? You have the nucleus, which is the protons and neutrons. You have the electrons. You have a whole what's called many, many other particles, you see? And therefore, this is really what the Big Bang. It is a transition between a spiritual dimension and a physical dimension. But what's interesting is that when it does create the physical dimension, it will create the greatest form or the most subtle form of the matter, which is energy. And that's really what energy is, and so on. You see, now, what is interesting, therefore, is that if the universe is really a bowl of soup, which consists of pure energy, then all the matter of the universe really is created from that energy. Now, the way that matter comes out of energy is you have to impart motion to different parts of the soup. So if somehow you get the energy in the soup, you see, and you move a little part of the energy, the soup bowl, so to speak, right, that will turn into matter, which, of course, is the atoms and the molecules and so on. You see, and that's the reason why I mentioned last week that one of the fundamental principles is that everything is in motion, which is interesting. Why is everything moving? In fact, when motion stops, which is called absolute zero, which is, if I remember correctly, 459.67 degrees below zero. Can you imagine how cold that is? Or 273 degrees Celsius. That means absolute zero is really when the atom stops moving totally. Totally. What happens to the matter when it stops moving? That's a very interesting question. And there are two people, Bose and Einstein. They came out with what's called a Bose-Einstein condensate. And what they say, and this actually was done in the 90s, and the people who did this got the Nobel Prize, they actually were able to create they got down the motion of an atom. It was only 1/1,000,000th of a degree, or even less, 1/10 of 1% of 1,000,000,000 degrees, or 1/1,000,000th of a degree, right, next to absolute zero. That's how close they came. And they found that when the atoms almost stopped moving, then all of a sudden they all lose their individuality and they merge together as one block, you see, which is what I'm saying. And that's what's called the Bose-Einstein condensate, which is an incredible state of matter where nothing is moving, almost nothing is moving. But when matter doesn't move, it turns back into the soup, into the bowl of energy, you see. So that's why the universe, everything in the universe, is moving in order to allow the energy to turn into matter, you see. So that's a special state special situation that actually creates matter. Now, you could talk a lot about that, you see. But basically what I'm trying to connect is what's the understanding, the explanation for what science recognizes, you see, and which they have no explanation. Now, from this, what is fascinating is the following idea. We now understand the Big Bang, which is really the transition between spiritual forces, but at a certain level of reality, which is called, as I mentioned, the fourth floor, which is Olam HaSiya, which is created by the diminishment of the output of spheres. And at that point in time, on the fourth floor, right, it changes into what I said is the Olam HaShofel, which is the lower world, which is our universe. And the way it does that, like I said, is that the forces of that world, which is Asiya, right, it has not only the light, the energy, the light, but it has a glow. And that glow creates energy. And that is the transition between spirituality and physicality. And then once you have a block of energy, you see, which explodes, because that's the origin of the whole universe, right, then automatically with it, like I said, you have the creation of time and space as well as energy. And eventually, once you have energy, if you impart motion to different aspects of the energy soup, that will turn into matter. You see? It's very interesting how it works. Now, this explains phenomena which doesn't make any sense. And I will just explain, you know, three of them. One of them which has tremendous consequences for Hashkafa and the whole concept of free will. Now, the first one is that if you take an electron, or rather two electrons, which are part of the atom, and all of a sudden they are together because they're in the same atom, and what happens if you separate them and you have one electron flying off in one direction, and it flies off in that direction at the speed of light, which is 186,000 miles a second, which is incredible. That means that electron can go around the Earth 7 times in 1 second. And what happens if you go to the other electron and you have it, again, travel, but in the exact opposite direction, also at the speed of light, you see? So you have two electrons, which were formerly what's called entangled together, and you take one and it's speeding off in one direction, the other is speeding off in the exact opposite direction. But remember, they're speeding away from each other at the speed of light, you see? Now, what happens after, obviously in 1 second they are, you know, 186,000 miles away, but what happens before that, right? Now the electron, which is interesting, spins. It has what's called spin, without getting into it, but it actually spins like a top, you see. And what happens if you subject one electron to a magnet, which flip its spin? In other words, it's like a, you know, it's spinning one way, and then you flip the spin, and all of a sudden it's spinning the other way. The question is, you've changed a certain aspect of that electron. Well, wait a minute, what happened to the other electron? It won't know what happened to, let's say, electron A, and you change its spin. Well, what about electron B? You see, it doesn't know what happened to A. Why? Because, as Einstein said, nothing can go faster than the speed of light. So if they're both going away from each other at the speed of light, right, so clearly if something happens to A, B will not know, because there's no way that B could know what happened to A, right, because they're both speeding away from each other at the speed of light, so no information can travel from one to the other, because nothing moves that fast. But what they find is that electron B knows what happens to A instantly, and simultaneous, when you flip the switch or you flip the spin of electron A, then electron B, no matter where it is, will also flip at the same instant in time. Now, that's one of the greatest puzzles of science. How does one A know what happened to B? If it's impossible for any information to go from A to B, because nothing can go faster than the speed of light, according to Einstein. Well, if we understand what I just said, you see, that really both of these things emerge from energy. Remember, because if you impart motion to any part of that soup, that motion will create matter. It'll create substance. So if what we're really looking at is a energy soup, so to speak, you see, so really one electron and the other electron are all part of the same energy soup. There's no difference. So if you think about it, if you flip the spin of one, the other one knows, not because it receives information from electron A. No, because electron A and electron B come from the same soup, of energy, because that's the concept of the sphera that gives rise to the energy soup. It's really one, you see. So because of that, the electrons know what's happening. In fact, every electron in the entire universe knows exactly what's happening to every other electron, because they're all really all part of the same energy soup, you see. So that explains this whole concept of entanglement. Then there's another phenomena, also fascinating. What happens if you take an electron and you have it go toward a wall? Now, the electron has a charge, whatever that means, and it's negative. And the wall, it's possible to make the wall positively charged, whatever that means. So immediately the electron, right, will go toward the wall, and of course it will go toward the wall or through it. But what happens if the wall becomes negative? So the electron is negative and the wall is negative. So the electron cannot go through the wall. It stops, and it's possible to do that with magnets and so on, whatever. But they find that the electron, when it's about to hit the wall, and it can't because the wall is also charged negatively, the electron disappears. And guess what? Lo and behold, it reappears at the opposite side of the other side of the wall, almost as if it went through a tunnel. And this phenomenon is called tunneling. This phenomenon is called tunneling. But how do we understand that? That means the electron goes out of existence and it emerges back into existence at the other side of the wall. No, and how do you even understand that? That something can come in and out of existence, you see. And the answer is the same idea. Because it disappears back into the soup, and therefore it disappears. The electron becomes pure energy, so to speak, and then it emerges on the other side of the wall. It reappears, you see. Apparently, it still has the potential of motion, which will make it reappear. So again, we encounter that the whole reality is nothing more than an energy soup, you see, which is the projection or the emergence of the transition or the change of a sphera, you see. So that's also explained. Then there's another idea, which has a great deal to do with Hashkafa, especially free will. They find, I don't get too complicated, but there's a certain principle called anthropic principle. Anthropic means man, the principle of man's consciousness. They find that the way subatomic particles can behave depends on you. It's almost like there's no real, what do you call it, absolute reality. It all depends on you. I give an example. And this is a famous experiment where they fired, right, light, which is consists of photons, whatever. Now, nobody really knows if light is a wave, which means it has no substance, but rather it's a wave in something else, because that's what a wave is. Wave is nothing more than a shaping of, let's say, water. A wave is not something in itself. It's the shape of water as it travels, you see. So nobody really knows exactly what light is. Is it a wave, which means it's a shape in something, or is it a particle, a bunch of little particles, and that's what light is. What is fascinating, if you aim a beam of light at a board that has two slits, you see, then the light will go through both slits at the same time, right, because you shine it at the wall. And behind that board, you have a wall, you see. Now, if it's a wave, then the shape of that light that you went through the two slits, will appear in a certain way. Let's call it, shape A, if it's a wave. But what happens if it's a particles, which are called photons, then what will appear on that wall behind the two slits looks different. Let's say it's shape B. You see, this is called the double slit experiment. So which is it? The amazing thing, it all depends what you think will happen. If you think that light is a wave, then that light beam will exhibit wave-like properties on that wall. But if you're looking to see if it's particles, then guess what? The reality changes. And on that wall behind the two slits, it will exhibit a shape like particles. But how can that be? Which is it? And what they discover is that it's up to you. It depends on what your consciousness wants to see. But that's incredible. Isn't there an objective reality? How could it be dependent on consciousness of you, the observer? Yet that's what they find. They've replicated this experiment who knows how many times, and it's always the same. So what we begin to see is that the level of subatomic particles, it behaves based on your consciousness or what you expect or what you observe, which is astounding, you see. And that's what it means, the anthropic principle, that what happens to subatomic particles is up to your consciousness. It doesn't have an independent reality. It all depends on what you want to see, you see. Now, that has tremendous hashkafic implications, and they will explain basically why, you see. Because what we don't understand is that we, the Rebbeinu Shem, gave us free will. That means we can determine exactly what we want to decide to do, you see. We have free will, which means we determine or make a decision about what we want to do, you see. But whatever we decide, we have the power, because of our decisions, to change the configuration or the amount of ha'ora of the spheres. Yes, they are subject to the consciousness of man. And since we can decide because we have free will, do we want to go down path A? So then the spheres will actually react to your decision and appear in a certain way, you see. Or we can decide path B, and then those spheres will act in a different way. So what the Rebbeinu Shem has done is he has given man's free will and his consciousness, you see, the ability to affect the output of the spheres, you see. But this is only true basically, at least reality-wise, of the subatomic world, you see. So it comes out that a person who decides to do something actually has an influence, you see, on the spheres themselves. And they arrange themselves in whatever way based on what that person wants. You see? So it's like the spheres await the decision of man, which is incredible. That's what consciousness is, and that's what free will in consciousness does. The Hebrew term for that is Isarusa Dilatato. Isarusa means the awakening dilatato from below. In other words, we decide the configuration of the spiritual world, the spheres themselves, and all the worlds, and so on. We actually decide, because God connected the spheres to man and his consciousness and his free will. Animals, however, they don't decide, right? The spheres, God decides what happens to animals or whatever, other life forms, and therefore the spheres give out their output, and they determine the behavior of animals, insects or whatever. Therefore, the movement goes from the top or the world of the spheres to the life on earth. That's called Isaruso, the awakening, right? Dilamaila, from above. So all life forms are made to move because they don't have free will. So the spheres, right, they react to what the Gzera is, whatever God wants to do. So you know, when God interacts with the world, he will change configurations of the spheres, which will affect whatever life form is connected to that area of sphera, you see. So that's an awakening or movement starts from above and goes below. But man is the only life form, since he has free will, and all mankind has free will, whether you're Jewish or not, just a different area. You decide what reality is. That is the power of Bechira, you see. Now, as part of free will, now, as part of that, you see, since you decide what reality is, because your behavior or your expectations or your consciousness actually will arrange the output of spheres, you actually do that. So like I say, the movement is from dilatata, from below, to above, you see. And therefore what will happen is based on your consciousness decision, therefore the spheres will be altered, configured based on what you decide, and then it will give its output back down to you. So you actually influence the spheres, how they will react, and therefore how they will determine your behavior. So it's the reverse. What is very interesting is that's why this seems to occur at a subatomic level, is that, which is really unheard of, is that if you decide you want to look to see if light is particles, right, your consciousness actually creates a reality of light behaving as a particle. It actually makes the reality of light behave in a certain way. Why? Because you have influenced by your consciousness the arrangement of spheres and their output, and that actually influences, since you have free will, the actual position of light. However, if you want to see not light as a particle, but light as a wave, then automatically that light will behave as if it was a wave and therefore make a certain type of shape at a wall behind the two slits in the board, you see. And that's called the anthropic principle. But we now understand why. Because man has free will. And what that means is you can actually alter the configuration of spheres by your free will, by your consciousness, you see. And that automatically will now come back down on the earth and actually change or determine reality. But basically it seems to work only on the subatomic level, you see. And that's a very important concept, you see. So it comes out that Hashkafa can actually influence, or rather the ideas of Hashkafa can explain what happens, how the world is created. And it can actually explain an area of knowledge called quantum mechanics, which people have, they don't know what's going on. It doesn't make sense. You know, for instance, you know what I said, you know, how can something appear and disappear? It disappears and then appears out of nowhere. And the answer I said was the soup, because it becomes part of the soup from which it emerged, right? And then it disappears into that soup. And then all of a sudden, it comes out of the soup again to become matter, you see. And the same thing, like I mentioned, with the anthropic principle, which is the principle that we determine the reality of subatomic particles, depending on our consciousness, which is what we freely want to think about and so on. Now, there's a great deal of other ideas that one can say, see. But my main message with this is that the entire physical universe, you see, is dependent on the transition between a spiritual world or forces, which are the spheres, you see, and the dependent on that, these spiritual forces, and what they created, you see. And that's a very important concept. And that's where Kabbalah meets science, you see. So therefore, when, like I say, the glow of the light of a sphere, when they create an energy soup, and that becomes a big bang. All of a sudden, everything begins from transition from the aura, the glow of the sphere, and that makes the entire universe. Comes out that the entire universe is really nothing more than a field of energy. I called it the soup. You know, it's like a bowl of soup where the whole thing is liquid, you know. The entire universe is really nothing more than a field, it's called, of energy, like a super, an energy soup in a bowl and so on, you see. And all things come out of that. So what we see, therefore, is Kabbalah, you know, has a whole different, a unique approach to the whole concept of the creation of the world, you see. Now, ultimately, where this leaves us is that in starting from the Messianic era, everything will be reversed. We're ultimately, like I once mentioned, you see, is the energy of the spheres, or whatever you want to call it, the light, the power, and so on, of the spheres begins in the Emes HaMashiach, in the Messianic era, specifically by Mashiach ben Yosef, you see. And what that does is that it will increase its output, and that's really what we're talking about. With the spheres, right, they increase their output greater and greater. So what happens is the universe begins to what's called reverse itself, reversal of progression. So it goes from, you know, which I mentioned, there are four floors, there's a ground floor, and then there's four floors above that. And then the fifth floor on top of that was, of course, this world, the Olam HaShofer, you see. So what happens is it reverses. It goes from Olam HaShofer back into the fourth floor, you see, third floor, second floor, first floor, and then the whole, from the first to the fourth or fifth, becomes Olam Haba, which is the ground floor, you see. So the whole thing reverses, which ultimately means that the world, which is really energy soup, the whole thing is a field of energy, ultimately will reverse itself back into, not energy, but a spiritual presence, you see, of what's called Olam HaSiyah, because Olam HaSiyah really is spiritual. It will reverse itself back into that world, which is the fourth floor, which I had mentioned. You will go from what's called the Olam HaShofer, which is the lower world, which of course is our universe. It will retransition back into the fourth floor, which of course is purely spiritual. So as a result of that, there is no more Geshem. There's no physical materialism anymore, because the energy has been removed. It has reconverted back into the glow of the spheres at the level of Olam HaSiyah, which is the world of action. So that's really what the Messianic era initiates. It is the initiation of the reversal of the progression from lowering the output of the spheres into different realities, like I mentioned, the different realities, and then to reverse that process. With all those realities which are low, they reverse themselves, and they get higher and higher. So the first thing, which is Mashiach ben Yosef, what he essentially deals with, is not that he changes the physical universe. What he does is he gets rid of the Zoyama, he gets rid of the Satan, the satanic influence of the Satan, which is called Zoyama, that's his projection. He reverses that, you see, and he gets rid of that. And that really is part of the Olam HaShofer, which is the universe that Adam Marishan introduced as a result of his sin. So the Mashiach ben Yosef's primary avodah, his work, is to reverse the Zoyama, gone, you see. And now the world becomes pure Geshem, pure materialism, which still is, in many ways, it's pure energy without Zoyama. Because Zoyama of the Satan is an add-on, you see, to the physical world. And that is removed, so now the world is purely physical, without any contamination of tumor, whatever, you see. And it's a pure energy, but it's still physical. And then once the Mashiach ben Yosef ends, then you have Mashiach ben David, right? And that begins, in a certain sense, Mashiach ben David. It's like it begins to transition from the world of Geshem slowly into the world of really Gan Eden, you see. And Gan Eden really is the lowest part of the third floor, which is Olam Yetzirah. And slowly there's a transition of Olam HaGeshem, the world, the physical world, which I mentioned is the fourth floor. The Zoyama is removed by Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben David now restores the world to the way it looked by Adam HaRishon before the sin, which is pure Geshem, you see, no satanic contamination. And it begins to reverse slowly back into a spiritual dimension, which is really Gan Eden, you see. But it's only the smallest part of Olam Yetzirah, which is Gan Eden, okay? And then once the 6,000 years is over, which it will be, and even the Messianic era ends, then there's a tremendous reversal, where from 6,000 to 7,000, the whole Olam Yetzirah is the whole world, instead it goes from Asiya, which is the fourth floor, it completely changes to the third floor. That's what happens from 6,000 to 7,000. Then from 7,000 to 8,000, then Yetzirah changes. Remember, this is all spiritual, right? Yetzirah changes, and it becomes Bria, you see. And then from 8 to 9, then the whole world changes from Bria to Atzilus. And then in the beginning of the 9,000th year, the world changes from Atzilus, which is the highest level of Olam Hazeh, the most subtle, the greatest state of Olam Hazeh, and all of that now changes to what's called the ground floor. We have no idea what the reality of that is. Nobody knows, nobody has ever seen what the reality is of the ground floor or the world of Olam Haba, which in Kabbalah is called Adam Kadmon or primordial man. In any case, so now you see how really the whole thing is beautifully understood by examining some of the major mysteries of what's called cosmology or particle physics or whatever. So that gives you an idea what really goes on in order to get to this world, right? And what goes on in the reversal process. You really get a tremendous idea of what goes on. Now, you know, this Shkofa Shir can be extended, obviously, but I don't want to do that because then it gets much more technical and so on. But I wanted to give you what's called the scope, the overview, you know, and combine that with physics or particle physics or whatever, cosmology, and to show you that the Torah has the answers. It tells you exactly not only what happens in the spiritual universe, but it also tells you what happens in science. And when you combine the two, it's a beautiful, what's called, integration of ideas. So that's what I wanted to do in this particular shir. It gives you a feel of the scope of what Torah can give you, you know, and really as a way of a beautiful explanation in terms of the mysteries of science, you see. Okay. Any questions? I hope I've succeeded and wasn't too complicated.
What does Mashiach ben Yosef do? Does he use the Sefirah to get rid of the Zohama?
Yes. You can only use get rid of the Zayama by manipulating, I hate to use that word, but by manipulating the spheres. Because they are the things that create everything. You see. You know, it's like if you want to turn on a machine, we gotta flip a switch. You need electricity. You can't do any work unless it's mechanical. You know, you need electricity. In a certain sense, the energy of the spheres, if you want to use that word, it's like electricity. You need it to change matter, you see. So everybody needs the spheres. The difference is that he has access to change the spheres beyond what was restricted to them because of the original intent of creation. He can actually manipulate the spheres. And as a result of that, once the spheres are manipulated, where they reconfigure in different ways, and he creates miracles, because that's really what miracles are. What is nature? Nature is nothing more then the configuration of spheres, right, in a permanent way, or in a standard way, I should say. You see, but what happens if you alter the standard configuration of spheres? Guess what? You've altered nature. You've altered the laws of the physical world. So everything ultimately goes down to what is your input into the spheres, you see. And that's very important, like I said. And the greatest way, I might as well say this, the greatest way to input into the spheres is through mitzvahs. Because that's what a mitzvah does. Every time you do a mitzvah, it opens up or it reconfigures a sphere to give you the energy, the light of that sphere. The problem is because of the Zoyama, we cannot in any way enjoy that, or it doesn't happen in this world. But potentially, the sphere can be reconfigured by the mitzvah. You see, that's why mitzvahs in many ways are so incredibly important. Any other questions?
When we,
Rabbi,
I have a question. Let's say when we grow closer to Hashem by doing
when we what? When we what?
When a Jew grows closer to Hashem, grows his
yes.
connection with Hashem through mitzvah and through emunah, bitachon, and all that.
Yes.
He's
yes.
reconfigurating the sefirot within him to allow him a higher access to Hashem.
Yes.
So,
because
so
you have to remember, a sphere is a conduit. It's a conduit. That's really what a sphere is. A sphere is a conduit or a pipe, whatever you want to call it, that carries, right, the Ein Sof, which is the Shechina. And therefore, when you do a mitzvah and you influence the sphere, it gives you its output. But what an output really is, a greater connection to the infinite one, which is God. That's really what a sphere is. A sphere in itself has no power, but it happens to be the carrier of the Shechina. And because it is, right, if you can influence the sphere to give a greater output, well, guess what? That means you brought the Shechina closer to the physical universe. Well, guess what? If the real power of the spheres is the Shechina, well, that's the greatest of all powers. There's nothing that beats it, because the greatest power of all is the divine presence, the Shechina. And the carriers of this, the conduits, you see, the pipes, are the spheres.
So if we have that connection to do that for ourselves personally, Mashiach ben Yosef, he has it for all of the Jewish nation?
Mashiach ben Yosef?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, he is given the crown or the ability to manipulate the spheres far beyond what we can imagine. And therefore, he's commanded, actually, to alter reality. It's really what he does. But that's because he can manipulate the spheres in a way which is beyond what we've ever seen. I mean, that's how he brings down the Beis HaMikdash and so on, and that's how he does, how he can fight the nations of the world and alter them. Where does he get this power from, you see? Where does he get this hatzlocho, this success? And you find by Yosef HaTzadik, it says, V'chol asher osa, everything he did, hitzliach Hashem biyodoi, God made him successful. But how? He's not a magician. He can't do this stuff. He does it because God gave him a tremendous control of spheres, you see, and therefore anything he wanted to do. In other words, his consciousness or his desire to do anything automatically configured the spheres to allow an enormous amount of the Shechina to come down and do what he did, to do what he wants. But in the end, it's all the Ein Sof. It is all God. Nobody has any power. This is the mistake we all make. I don't care what it is. Spheres have no power in themselves. It's because they are the conduits, the pipes, you see, the vehicles for the Shekhinah, for the Ein Sof. That's their power. So if you can control the output of those spheres, you can do anything you want, including bringing the Geula, which is what he does. You see?
Is there a specific Sefirah that the Beit Mikdash comes down, or does it come down through all, or how does that work?
Well, once the Zoyama is gone, and that's the major Ikov, then the spheres themselves configure to allow the entry of the Shekhinah, which I once gave a shir about, from Olim Yetzira. In other words, the Shekhinah at the level of Olim Yetzira, right? Because at that level, the spheres have a certain output of the Divine Presence. And that output, whatever the number is, which is enormous, actually descends in a physical garb called a Beis HaMikdash Tachtoin, you see? Which I once explained, that we're actually the Beis HaMikdash HaShlishi, the third Beis HaMikdash, you see, is the Divine Presence as it inhabits the Beis HaMikdash, the Maila, in Olam Yetzirah. The whole thing descends to Olam Asiyah, or rather Olam HaShafel, which is called the universe, the lower world, you see? Yeah, that's how he does it. He is given control or access. How do you think Moshe Rabbeinu did the Makkos? How does a man make blood? The whole Nile River turns to blood, right? And we're not talking about colored water. We're talking about blood, you know. In other words, they could have taken the Red Cross could have taken that as blood and used it for transfusions. It's the real stuff. Because he was given the access to those spheres, right, that could do that, that can change the physical universe, you see? And that's what he did. In other words, the energy soup, he had control of that energy soup. Well, guess what? If you can control the energy soup, which really is controlling the spheres that give it emergence, where it emerges, then you could do anything you want. Once you can control the spheres, then you can control the energy soup, which is the greatest form of physicality. Once you could do that, then they control matter. Well, guess what? Once you control that, then no big deal to change the whole Nile River to blood or any of the makas that he did. You see? And of course, he was allowed to do that, right? And that's why, by the way, the Mate had all 10 spheres, or I should say all 10 makas, engraved on it, you see? And therefore, he was given the power to activate the spheres that would change reality. And I'm explaining that means that the spheres, which creates the energy soup, which is the beginning of physical reality, and therefore the matter that emerges from that, is the makas. You see? He was given that power, and that is the power of a goyel, of a redeemer. You see? And the one who will have that power initially, Mashiach ben Yosef.
But I thought Mashiach ben Yosef he doesn't kill the Zohama. He fights it, but then Mashiach ben David comes and kills it.
Yes. What he he subdues it.
So he subdues it enough where the Beit HaMikdash could come down.
Yeah. Because remember, the main idea is to terminate the power of the Zohama, of the Satan. You need to terminate that. Now, whether that means that who originates the Zoyama, right? It's the Satan. So there's a machloekus. Either he is killed as an angel. So obviously if he's killed, then his projected power, which is the Zoyama, is also terminated because he's dead or he ceases to exist. Or there's a shita that holds that he changes himself and he becomes a malach toiv, a good malach, and so on. So either way, there's no more Zoyama because there's no more evil source. The origin of evil is gone, you see.
So when does Mashiach ben Yosef start to gain that access to the Sefirot, where he could manipulate them for miracles?
When he gets the Echid of Adam HaRishon. Because that's the crown, the messianic crown. You see, when he gets that crown, spiritual crown that is, you see, that's when he can do all of this stuff. Until then, he is what's called a Shirish of Ben Yosef. He has a root soul of the Mashiach, which means that he is the candidate to be Mashiach Ben Yosef. But he is not. He's a candidate. And that itself indicates tremendous amount of potential, which I once mentioned, which itself is in the Klipa, which is figuratively, it's like being in prison. But in any case, but once that ends, and he actually has access to it, and he gets that, the what's called the Yechida, which is the highest level of soul. There are five aspects, and that's the highest. When he gets that, that used to belong to Adam HaRishon, you see, and it flew off because of the sin of Adam. So the Yechid of Adam HaRishon is off Adam, flew away, so it was never contaminated by the sin of Adam HaRishon. And that splits in half, which I once mentioned. Part of it goes to Mashiach ben Yosef when the decree of redemption is now present. And the other part goes to Mashiach ben David. But it's that crown, which is the Yechidah of Adam HaRishon, that's what emerges, that's what gives the power of both of these people, you see, to access control of the spheres. That's what does it. And that is what we're waiting for. You see?
So when the Pekida happens, he automatically gets the Yechidah?
Yes. Yes, that's what the Pekida is. That's what we pray. The Pokid. And then he is released. You see, and then after that, you have the Shekhinah that is released. Two different stages. That's called the Zechirah.